So on the one hand, Van Til will say, fallen man cannot know anything in principle because of his hermeneutical framework, his fallen hermeneutical framework. But God's common grace allows fallen man to have some knowledge. And I think that is part of what caused me the most confusion when I initially dove into Van Til, because when you're reading Van Til, he will say, you know, 9 times out of 10, he's focusing on this antithesis between fallen man and redeemed man. And so he's constantly emphasizing fallen man cannot know anything. Fallen man doesn't know the tree truly. He doesn't know anything truly. There are no facts and no laws in common between the Christian, the believer, and the unbeliever. And then maybe 10% of the time, you'll run across the common grace qualification. So, you know, every 200 or 300 pages, you'll run across him qualifying the antithesis and saying,
does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where we model faith seeking understanding as we together gaze at the beauty of the Lord with the great tradition. I am Matthew Barrett, and I am so excited to hand things over in this episode to another fellow theologian and friend of mine. You may be wondering, hey, why are you doing that? Well, actually, I am taking this time to write a systematic theology with Baker Academic. It's hard work. I'm deep in the books, and you could pray for me. I am hoping that this work will bear much fruit, and I get to share it on the Credo Podcast in the years ahead. Well, in the meantime, I think you're really going to enjoy some of the guest theologians I have on the Credo Podcast and hearing and learning from some of their wisdom in the weeks and months ahead.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where we model faith-seeking understanding as we contemplate God together with the wisdom of the great tradition. I'm your host today, Samuel Parkinson. I'm the Associate Professor of Theology at the Gulf Theological Seminary in the UAE, and I'm the Director of Publishing at Credo Magazine. This episode of Credo Podcast is sponsored by Reformation Heritage Books. And one thing to emphasize with Reformation Heritage Books is their Puritan Treasures for Today series. This is a new series where they're making the riches of these godly writers of old accessible for modern readers with updated language and helpful introductions. And it includes classic works from authors such as John Owen, Jeremiah Burroughs, and other Puritan authors. And so if you're interested in reading accessible introductions to the Puritans and getting the most out of them as you can, then we would encourage you to go to reformationheritagebooks.org. And if you use the coupon code CREDO, you can save 10% on your first order. I'm joined today by Keith Matheson. Keith is the professor of systematic theology at the Reformation Bible College, in Sanford, Florida, where he's been working there for 14 years and has been working with Ligonier Ministries for much longer than that. He's the author of several important and helpful books, including Given for You, Reclaiming Calvin's Doctrine of the Lord's Supper, sort of recasting and trying to retrieve a faithful articulation of Calvin's view of the Lord's Supper, as well as the book that we're going to talk about in today's episode, which is Toward a Reformed Apologetics, a critique of the thought of Cornelius Van Til. This is a book that I thoroughly enjoyed reading. I was honored to write an endorsement for this book. And one thing that I mentioned in the book is that my only charge against it is that it wasn't written 15 years sooner. And so you can imagine, I think very highly of it, and I'm excited to talk to Professor Matheson about this today. So, Professor Matheson, thank you for joining us here on the Credo Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned before, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation today. I wanted to start maybe with just some introductory matters. You get into this a little bit in the introduction of the book, but maybe you can fill our listeners in on how you became interested in the writings of Cornelius Van Til. So maybe you could introduce our listeners to him and then describe your history with his work.
Yes, I would say there's been two stages of interest in Van Til for me. It began when I transferred from Dallas Seminary to Reform Seminary here in the Orlando, Florida area. The faculty at Orlando, the Orlando campus of RTS, consisted of several people who took wildly different views of apologetics. So we had Dr. R.C. Sproul here, who is not a Van Tilian, was not, Richard Pratt, who's written a little introductory book on presuppositionalism called Every Thought Captive. He was for Van Til. Then Ronald Nash, who took a completely different view. And there were camps of students who took different positions depending on which professor they were following. And so that debate was just ongoing on that campus. And I was very new to Reformed theology at the time, very new to this whole debate. So I started reading as much as I could and tried reading as much Van Til as I could. Can't say I fully understood him at that point. It took years and years before I could say I even grasped what he was saying. But then after leaving RTS, there's probably a period of about 20 years where that issue just did not come up for me. I was busy doing other things, working on other topics. I wasn't reading Van Til. I'd come to a position on him, and it wasn't Van Tilian. And then when I started teaching at Reformation Bible College, one of the classes I was asked to teach was the doctrine of God. And as I began jumping back into that topic and just reading a lot to prepare for lectures, one of the things that I noticed in recent years was that some very prominent evangelical and even Reformed theologians were teaching some strange things about the doctrine of God. And two of those men were very well-known prominent students of Cornelius Van Til. And so the wheels started turning, and I was wondering, is there something in Van Til that would explain why two of his most prominent students are saying what they're saying on the doctrine of God? So I jumped back into Van Til's writings, trying to figure that out. And one thing led to another over the last 6-7 years, wrote a few small things, and then was asked to write this larger book. So my interest in Van Til was initially rekindled by my interest in these debates concerning the doctrine of God. Mm. But it's been a long time since my main interest was in the apologetics debate. But as I jumped back into it, I became re-interested in that debate. And when I was invited to write this book, I thought, well, maybe I can do something constructive on this.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And honestly, it harmonizes well. It rhymes with my own sort of experience with Van Til, my own history with Van Til. So I can't even remember how I came across his writings. But as soon as I did, I became a voracious reader of Van Til, collecting everything that I possibly could get my hands on by him and really trying to read it, and was a proud Van Tilian. In fact, I like to describe my own tendency towards cage stage everything. You know, it's not just Calvinism cage stage for me. It's cage stage presuppositional apologetics. It's cage stage ecclesiology. It's cage stage regulative principle. You know, that's just my personality, is I just kind of lurch forward from one theological position to another. It's something I've become aware. I'm trying to get under control. But that was when I discovered Van Til. There was something that was deeply attractive, that there was something that struck me about an internal coherence to the way that he presented things, even though, you know, he's notorious for being difficult to understand. But I have found that if once you sort of get the way that he uses language, he's pretty clear in sort of presenting the overall system of his thought. And there is a kind of attractive internal consistency with it that dazzles. And so that was my own sort of what drew me to Van Til. And the thing that and so I just kind of understood myself as a Van Tilian and kind of left that on the back burner. Meanwhile, these other theological, you know, journeys I'm going through, bringing me towards a more classical understanding of Trinitarian theology, a classical understanding of theology proper. It was also theology proper and Trinitarian theology that basically encouraged me to sort of re-examine what it was that I thought that I had learned from Van Til. And because I started noticing many similar things. We're probably thinking of some of the same scholars when we're thinking of students of Van Til who are tinkering with the doctrine of God, you could say. And so that kind of forced me back into the literature of Van Til and what actually is being, you know, taught by Van Til. And so I describe myself as a former Van Tilian now, in large part because of the, maybe you could say, a reassessment of his thought and in the light of classical and confessional theology. And so I definitely got a strong sense of that in the second half of your book, but we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I wanted to describe for our listeners your book. It's neatly divided up into two halves. The first half, you're basically just summarizing Van Til's teaching in several key areas. And then it's not until the second half of the book that you really begin your assessment and criticism of each of those, you know, areas that are covered in the first section. And I thought this was wonderful, the way that you presented the material. I can imagine a Van Tilian reading and agreeing with virtually everything that you say in the first half of the book. You know, I can put myself in my former Van Tilian shoes and read the first half of your book and say, yes, he's got him exactly right. He's got Van Til exactly right. So my question is, why was it important for you to organize the book in that way? Why was it important for you, important for fruitful dialogue, that is, between Van Tilians and non-Van Tilians, for you to simply present his thought and describe it before you move on to assess it and criticize it?
Well, there's actually a couple of reasons why I ended up doing that in the first half of the book. And first, I just strongly believe that if you're going to criticize anybody's position, you need to accurately state what that position is. I've been taught my entire adult life in theological education to avoid straw men if possible. So I wanted to state as accurately and as concisely as possible what it is he's saying. So if I'm critiquing it, I'm at least critiquing what exists, and we can move from there. But second, in my experience with this debate over Van Til over the last 30 plus years, I've not found anybody that's really written a concise explanation of his system of thought from beginning to end. A lot of times it'll start with the antithesis or something like that, and skipping over a lot of important details that you need to understand in order to understand what in the world the antithesis is. And a lot of people who present Van Til's system will present it in deeply philosophical terms that a lot of lay Christians and others who don't have a strong foundation in philosophy can't quite follow. So I was trying to kill two birds with one stone. Number one, make an attempt to the best of my ability to present a statement of what he believes that allows anybody who's biblically informed and even mildly theologically literate to be able to follow his process of thought, starting with the doctrine of God and showing how if you start with the doctrine of God and the divine decree and you move to his doctrine of creation, to the fall, to redemption, to the antithesis, then you can understand why he says what he says about apologetics. Mm-hmm. But if you just jump in anywhere in the middle, it leads to a lot of the kinds of confusion that I've had about Van Til over the decades, some puzzlement about things he said. So I just wanted to try to go back to square one and say, how did he get to this point where he's making these these very strong claims about the presuppositional method. You go back to the antithesis. Well, why is he saying this about this? And you have to go back to redemption. And I just kept working my way back and realizing, to me, doing it in a biblical theological manner helps pretty much anybody grasp the basics of what it is he's saying. Yeah. And I think that's been at least one of the major reasons why this debate has just been people talking past each other for so long. Because every time anybody has criticized Van Til, the immediate response is, well, you just didn't understand him.
Yeah.
And that may be true. Maybe we're not. Mm-hmm. But if nobody's understanding him, then the first thing we have to do is take care of that problem.
Yeah.
Understand what he's saying. So I decided I'm going to devote the first half of this book to doing, to the best of my ability, understanding him and studying what he says. And I ran this by a number of Vantillians, and without naming any names, it might embarrass them, but they've told me I got him right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm hopeful that what you said is true, that Vantillians, when they read part one, will recognize Van Til in part one. It's extensively quoting Van Til, probably to the point of tedium, where there's almost a footnote on every sentence. But I wanted to make sure I didn't twist his words in any way.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And I think you've nailed it. Even just the way that you presented that, in order for us to understand what Van Til is doing with the antithesis, we have to understand what he's doing with the divine decree. And in order to understand what he's saying about the divine decree, we have to understand what he says about theology proper. I think that's right. And it jives with what I hear contemporary Vantillians calling for. So when I listen to a scholar like Lane Tipton talk about Van Til, that what you're saying sounds familiar. It sounds like something that he would say, that in order to understand what he's doing with the application of his apologetic, method or something like that, you have to understand his biblical theological framework. You have to understand his Vossian view of the covenants, and you have to understand, his view of theology proper. And so I think in terms of framing, I think you've nailed it in terms of trying to understand Van Til on his own terms, and in terms that defenders of Van Til today would acknowledge and agree with, that yes, these are the terms that we have to sort of understand Van Til on. And so maybe we could begin to dig in a little bit. And also, I forgot to mention at the beginning of this podcast, we're hoping that this is going to be at least a two-part episode. So we're not going to get to everything in this podcast. So listeners, be patient. We're trying to dig in a little bit so that we don't treat this subject and Van Til as a thinker with flippancy. We want to be respectful and really dig in. And so maybe we could begin to dig in with where you begin, chapter one of your book, and talk about his doctrine of God, specifically his doctrine of the Trinity. So maybe I could ask the question this way. What about Van Til's Trinitarianism is just simply conventional, confessional, Trinitarianism, and what are some of the distinctives that he's bringing to the table when it comes to understanding the doctrine of the Trinity?
To begin with, his basic doctrine of the Trinity is just straightforward Westminster Trinitarianism, at least at the foundation. And when he expounds on the doctrine of the Trinity, he's often citing and using the language of Herman Bavinck. So he's reading Westminster through this Dutch theological lens, and at least on the surface, you have a lot of the same basic points: one God, three persons, and he'll use this. We can talk about this later on, but he'll use this to explain what he calls the philosophical problem, and others call the philosophical problem of the one and the many. So mm-hmm. he thinks the Trinity provides us a theological solution to that problem. Where Van Til is distinctive and unique in his doctrine of the Trinity is, while he confesses that God is three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, he also adds this point that God is also one person. Mm. And Defenders of Van Til have long argued that the reason he's saying that is he's simply trying to make the point that God is not an impersonal force. And so when they're saying that when Van Til says that God is three persons and that God is one person, that he's simply trying to deny that God is impersonal. In the second half of the book, I raise some concerns with the problems that kind of formulation causes, not only for at the lay level, just mere terminological confusion, but some of the deeper theological problems that can arise if you assert that God is three persons and one person. And I think every one of us, whether Vantillian or not, would grant that God is not an impersonal force. Mm-hmm. I simply think that the language of Nicaea and the Westminster Confession already deals with that by affirming that God is tripersonal and by affirming that God has intellect, knowledge, will, that already precludes an impersonal right. force. And so it's not necessary to do this. But Van Til was interacting with a lot with idealist philosophy quite a bit. And idealists often suggested this idea of an impersonal absolute. And as the what Van Til would call the ultimate principle of interpretation, he wanted to replace the principle of an impersonal absolute with a personal God. Mm. And I think he felt compelled to try to refute that idealist notion of an impersonal absolute by affirming that God is personal. I just don't think it was necessary to do it in the way he did. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very, at best, it's inherently confusing.
Hi friends, this is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting our podcast to tell you about a special opportunity. On May 1st through 2nd, 2025 in Washington, D.C., we will host our first ever Credo Conference. And yes, 2025 is a strategic year because this is the big anniversary of Nicaea and the Nicene Creed. We will have speakers such as Kevin DeYoung, Michael Horton, Gavin Ortland, Michael Reeves, Fred Sanders, and myself. And not only speakers, but breakout sessions in which these speakers will sit down with you in a small setting and pore over a classical text with you and have a Socratic dialogue. We can't wait for May 1st and 2nd. I hope you will join me at the Credo Conference. Let me invite you to register right away. Go to credomag.com. I can't wait to see you there.
Yeah. Well, let's jump forward then just a little bit on this point. I know that we could probably spend the whole rest of the episode talking about Van Til's Trinitarianism, but you alluded before in your answer that you foresaw some problems with articulating the doctrine of the Trinity in that way, where you could describe God as one person and also three persons. So just in brief, what are some of the major concerns that you have for Van Til's Trinitarianism in general?
Well, that formulation, one person and three persons, at the most basic level, it's reintroducing problems that existed in the fourth century Trinitarian debates, where there was still a lot, at least early on in the fourth century, when there was still a lack of clarity over terminology. Mm-hmm. What word are we going to use to speak of God as one, and what word are we going to use to speak right. of God as three, in terms like ousia and hypostasis that were had a lot of overlap in 325 over the course of that century are gradually distinguished. And we're going to use this to talk about what is one and this to talk about what is three. And going back to the point where we're using the same word to talk about what is one and what is three recreates and reintroduces a lot of the same confusion that existed in the early part of the Trinitarian debate. So at the very at the basic level, I don't think it's necessary to reintroduce terminological confusion. Second, if you're saying that God is one person and three persons, that terminological confusion means you're either using person in exactly the same sense, which means you're contradicting yourself and you're introducing nonsense into the doctrine of the Trinity, or you're using person in a completely different sense and you're equivocating,
which
also introduces incoherence into your doctrine, which means that if you're proclaiming this from a lectern or a pulpit, you're going to confuse everybody who's listening. It causes Christ's sheep to stumble theologically, and it creates a recipe for heresy in people's minds. Whether or not Van Til went there is a secondary question, but the kind of problems it causes when you're teaching and preaching this is dangerous to the sheep. And then third, the way Van Til defends and tries to explain this doctrine of one person, three persons, is by comparing the way the three persons are related to the oneness of God. Mm. He compares that to the way the divine attributes are related to the oneness of God. And given the doctrine of divine simplicity, that creates enormous issues, because the way the three persons are distinguished is not identical to the way the attributes are distinguished. And if you try to equate them, you're going to end up denying the Trinity. You're going to end up denying the personal properties and falling into some type of monistic Unitarian view of God if you're consistent with this. Mm-hmm. Now, thankfully, most people who are in the Van Tilian camp don't push it to that extreme, and the Westminster Confession holds that kind of tendency in check. But if people push this if you actually deal with the three persons the way you deal with the attributes, and you affirm divine simplicity, you're going to annihilate the three persons, and they're going to become just names in one form or another.
Yes. And another thing, maybe this would be another potential danger, but just kind of along those same lines, I'm wondering if you would agree that you could also move it in the other direction. That is, in order to make those two frameworks of, you know, the multiple attributes being one in God and the three persons being one in God, if you want to take that analogy and kind of compare them, you could also move in the other direction, where you're not sort of becoming Unitarian, but you are essentially having to reformulate the doctrine of divine simplicity so that the way that the attributes are one in God is you're forced to articulate it in a way that is altogether different than the way that, you know, virtually the vast majority of the Christian tradition has articulated that doctrine of divine simplicity.
That might be an explanation for what got me back into Van Til in the first place. These students of Van Til who are tweaking the doctrine of divine simplicity and immutability and other attributes of God.
Yeah.
They're pushing in that direction.
And that's what I was going to suggest. The other thing too is that you mentioned this at the very beginning, but the confusion of person. I think that between those two options that you describe, either using the word person in the same way and in a univocal way, and so you're asserting a contradiction when you say one person and three person, or you're using the term in an equivocal way, and so it's just nonsense, where you're using one person in one sense and three persons in another sense. It reminds me of the way that social Trinitarians today formulate the doctrine of the Trinity. It kind of depends upon a misunderstanding of what we mean by person. And so it's not the same kind of misunderstanding, because I don't think that, you know, you could describe Van Til as a social Trinitarian, not in a strong sense in any way, but it's a similar kind of issue where you can't even sort of present his formula of the doctrine of the Trinity unless you're already just sort of, you know, unless you're already misunderstanding what the tradition has meant in describing a person, a hypostasis, and kind of importing a modernistic kind of idea of what a person must be. And it really does. I think that's the issue, because if it's true that Van Til is is saying that God is one person and three persons in order to protect us from formulating a doctrine of God that is deeply impersonal, if that's true, and if he deems that as a necessary move because distinguishing the persons from the one essence is insufficient for establishing that God is sufficiently personal, then I think that just means that he's not really done a thorough job of representing what the Christian tradition has meant whenever we use the word person. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair, and I think that explains a lot of the other debates that you alluded to that are going on today in connection with things like eternal subordination and so forth, that's also tied to a kind of social Trinitarianism where you're taking a modern and also a human understanding of what it is to be a human person and reading that back into the divine Trinity and not understanding the differences between the divine persons and creaturely persons. Yes, I think it's a widespread problem, and I think it's probably the biggest problem in the broader evangelical church today is this tweaking and recasting of the doctrine of God. All of the attacks on the and reframing of the divine attributes, all of the tweaking going on with the doctrine of the Trinity, I don't think the doctrine of the Trinity needs to be fixed. We can always further explain it, further clarify it. One of the editors of my book, Matthew Barrett, just released a gigantic tome collection of works on classical Trinitarianism that 40 or 50 authors in there that are doing what needs to be done to answer this problem that exists today.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's the kind of thing that we love to talk about here at Credo. I'm tempted to continue on this line of thinking and keep talking about Trinitarianism, but I think you know what we've discussed is sufficient enough to tease the listeners to go and pick up your book to read more. But I did want to move to another area of Van Til that is distinctive, and that is his epistemology. So Van Til's understanding of creation and revelation. I've seen many advocating. I advocated when I was a strict Van Tilian, but I've seen more people continuing to sort of recast this, trying to advocate for what they call a revelational epistemology. What is that, according to Van Til? What does he mean by revelational epistemology?
Well, page one of his book, Survey of Christian Epistemology, he actually explains it very briefly. If I could just read what he says, sure. I think it's fairly clear. He says, Van Til writes, "We may characterize this whole situation by saying that the creation of God is a revelation of God. God revealed himself in nature, and God also revealed himself in the mind of man. Thus, it is impossible for the mind of man to function except in an atmosphere of revelation. And every thought of man, when it functioned normally in this atmosphere of revelation, would express the truth as laid in the creation by God. We may therefore call a Christian epistemology a revelational epistemology." So at least for Van Til, when he's introducing that concept, it's very much tied to his understanding of general revelation, that everything God created is in his language, exhaustively revelational of God, including the mind of man, created in the image of God. So Adam is created in what he's calling this atmosphere of general revelation that's then supplemented by special revelation in the covenant, placing man in this ethical, epistemological environment. And I think that's important to understand for Van Til, because one of the things I think that some critics of Van Til have misunderstood about him is they think he denies general revelation altogether. Mm-hmm. And it's not that he denies general revelation. He thinks everything, every fact in God's creation is revelational, exhaustively revelational of God. It's natural theology. It's our response to general revelation where Van Til differs from most in the classical tradition. But I don't know how every contemporary Van Tilian is using the phrase revelational epistemology, but at least for Van Til, in the way he introduces the concept, it's distinctly tied to his concept of general revelation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you're right to sort of emphasize he's not denying revelation. In fact, or general revelation. In fact, if anything, he's maximizing the general revelation. That he's got a lot of these quotable phrases, but where he talks about how the unbeliever is confronted everywhere he goes with revelation of God. Everything is revelation of God. I think when it comes to epistemology, what he's really trying to deny is that there is. I don't know if I could say it this strongly, because he seems to sometimes he says things that make it seem that he's saying this, and then other times he says something that it doesn't seem like he's saying it, and but sometimes it feels as if what he's trying to deny are things like induction or almost like the idea that the unbeliever, because they can't relate every fact in the universe as a revelation of God, you know, they can't relate every fact in relation to one another as ultimately being a revelation of God, they therefore can't know any fact truly in what it actually is. And so when he says things like that, you almost get the impression that what he's saying is that unbelievers can't know anything. But then he'll say, well, I'm not saying that unbelievers can't know anything. But I have found that when you say things like that, like, okay, every fact in the universe, there are no brute facts. Every fact of the universe is intrinsically declaring the glory of God. You know, Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. The sky above proclaims his handiwork. So when you say something like that, like every fact of the universe is revelation of God. Therefore, if you are not seeing this fact as a revelation of God, then you're not seeing this fact truly for what it actually is. That seems to cohere, conceptually. And in my experience, that is one of the most attractive features of Van Til's thought, is his presentation of epistemology from a theological perspective. And yet you seem to indicate in your book that his epistemology as a whole has some problems. So what might some of those problems be?
Right. There's so many issues here, but going back to the doctrine of God, God, his whole understanding of epistemology runs like a thread from the doctrine of God all the way to his argument for the presuppositional method. And so with his doctrine of the triune God, God has omniscience. He infinitely and perfectly knows himself. And then importantly, with his divine decree, his eternal decree, he perfectly and exhaustively knows everything in the divine decree, every fact in the divine decree. And that means that God is the ultimate principle of interpretation for every fact in the divine decree, because he decreed it. And then when he creates every fact, and facts include everything, you know, every atom in the universe, every planet, every star, every blade of grass, but also every event, every thought, everything whatsoever comes to pass is included. And so all of those facts are included in the divine decree. Because they're decreed by God, they are what Van Til calls pre-interpreted by God. And therefore, when God creates man, man is required, and Adam did initially, interpret all facts as God decreed and God created facts. So even though man's knowledge wasn't exhaustive, it was analogical knowledge. It corresponded to God's knowledge. It placed God as the ultimate principle of interpretation, and it interpreted all facts in the light of God and in relation to each other in the divine decree. The problem, and what causes a lot of the difficulties in understanding Van Til, is what he says about the fall. Because with the fall, man, Adam, now, according to Van Til, places himself as the ultimate principle of interpretation. God has said, for example, eat this fruit and you will die. Satan comes along and says, if you eat this fruit, you will not die. Rather than just submitting to God's will, Adam says, I'm going to be the judge of what is right and wrong. So he judges what God says and judges what Satan says according to his own standard, placing himself as the autonomous principle of interpretation. And as soon as fallen man replaces God with himself, now he doesn't know any fact truly, in principle at least. In principle, if you interpret a God-decreed, God-created fact apart from the decreeing, creating God, then you don't know that fact truly. And so in principle, if fallen man is interpreting every fact as a non-decreed, non-created fact, then he doesn't know that fact truly. That if he sees that tree outside the window, and doesn't understand it as a God-decreed, God-created fact, then he doesn't know that tree truly. Where this causes confusion, like you said, is because Van Til will also say that man, fallen man, can know that tree is a tree. Well, how is that? So on the one hand, with the fall, not only is man making himself the ultimate principle, but Van Til says there's a curse on creation. So the general revelation, which is still objectively there, isn't as clear as it was before the curse of the fall. Man's mind is wounded, and man has this principle of interpretation that distorts everything and means he can't know anything truly in principle. However, and this is hugely important, God, in his common grace, prevents fallen man from taking that autonomous interpretive principle to its logical conclusion. He prevents a fallen man from interpreting everything in a way that would lead him to just complete skepticism and no knowledge at all. So by virtue of God's common grace, fallen man doesn't take his godless interpretive principle to its logical end, and therefore fallen man is able to know many things. So on the one hand, Van Til will say fallen man cannot know anything in principle because of his hermeneutical framework, his fallen hermeneutical framework. But God's common grace allows fallen man to have some knowledge. And I think that is part of what caused me the most confusion when I initially dove into Van Til, because when you're reading Van Til, he will say, you know, 9 times out of 10, he's focusing on this antithesis between fallen man and redeemed man. And so he's constantly emphasizing fallen man cannot know anything. Fallen man doesn't know the tree truly. He doesn't know anything truly. There are no facts and no laws in common between the Christian, the believer, and the unbeliever. And then maybe 10% of the time, you'll run across the common grace qualification. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every 200 or 300 pages, you'll run across him qualifying the antithesis and saying, fallen man is, by God's common grace, enabled to come to true knowledge. And if you miss those qualifications, it leads to a lot of confusion. But even if you grant the qualification, it leads to problems, because you're faced with this. And you know, I address this later on in the book, but how you view the antithesis is a major part of the argument for the presuppositional method of apologetics.
Right.
And so an absolute antithesis has one apologetical implication, and a qualified antithesis has another.
Exactly.
And that's one of the key problems in this chain of thinking. But going back, one other thing that's really very important to understand in Van Til's epistemology is when he's saying the fallen man has no true knowledge of the tree or anything else in principle, you have to ask what Van Til means by true knowledge.
Yeah.
And this was something I didn't catch, you know, in the first 30 years of reading Van Til, but if you go and reread all of Van Til's works and highlight every time he defines what true knowledge is over and over and over again, he will say things like, in order to know any one fact truly, you have to know every fact. You have to know every fact in relation to every other fact, and obviously in relation to God, the decreer and creator. So over and over and over again, he's making this statement that true knowledge is exhaustive, infinite knowledge. Yeah. And that's why God, who is omniscient and has exhaustive, infinite knowledge, provides the ground for any knowledge at all. Now, I don't personally, in my book, I explain why I don't think that really helps anybody but God, who never had a problem in the first place. But if true knowledge is defined as exhaustive, infinite knowledge, it still raises a problem for us because we don't have that. Whatever's in our mind, it's not omniscience. So Van Til tries to answer that problem with his concept of analogical knowledge. I just don't think it solves the problem.
Yeah, that was a really good presentation. I'm tempted to keep the conversation going. We're getting now to that time where we need to wrap up the conversation. I'll just say, listeners, one other point that we weren't really able to delve into here, but that J.V. Fesco gets into in his book on apologetics, is a critique of Van Til along the lines of Van Til's implicit denial of what we call common notions. This is something that's articulated in the Canons of Dort, for example, when they're describing how unbelievers retain a light of knowledge that enables them to know certain things, to, you know, conduct their lives in a particular way, to conduct societies in a particular way. But they're also very clear to say in such a way that they are altogether unable to come to any sort of saving knowledge or any sort of merit before God. And so that difference between natural knowledge and gracious knowledge that's well attested, especially in the Reformed tradition, is something that is kind of undergoes something of a transformation through Van Til's system. And so that would be another really helpful resource to kind of come at Van Til's epistemology from another angle, or maybe some of the consequences of Van Til's epistemology from another angle, specifically in this area of common notions. But man, there is so much more that I would love to talk to you about, Professor Matheson, about Van Til's epistemology. I think we're just going to have to call that for today. Maybe I can tease listeners for what we'll talk about in the next episode. I've not actually run these topics by you, but they're covered in your book, so hopefully they're fair game. But I would like to spend a little bit of time. I think we're going to have to talk about Van Til's understanding of the antithesis and his presuppositionalism. Just in general, as well as a handful of other topics that we will, you know, decide on before the podcast itself. But this is just part one. Part two, we'll continue to dig in a little bit more of Van Til's thought, and hopefully in a way that is fair to what he sought to do and what he was trying to do, and is respectful in that respect. But also we want to understand where, if at all, Van Til diverges from more of a classical understanding of God and more of a Reformed perspective of apologetics and how these things actually work themselves out in the daily Christian life. So Professor Matheson, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Credo Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.